God, who is making all things new. Amen. So in about 20 minutes, a flood of people are going to try to get in here. So if you would make room for those who did not change their clocks, that would be great. They'll come right in that door. So be ready for them. It's a sign of our hospitality. And then don't mention a thing. It is the season of Exodus. We're in the midst of a season, 40 days, of paying attention to the themes of captivity and liberation. Paying attention the first week to the notion of being captive to temptation. Paying attention last week to the notion of being captive to self-preservation. And this week, paying attention to a different sort of captivity, which has something to do with loyalty and conflict avoidance and keeping the peace. And so I want to go there if I could. I remember the very first time in my life that I defected in place. The very first time I spoke up and said, you know, gosh darn it, I don't like this. This isn't working for me anymore. And I remember specifically the feelings of an upset stomach. I recall specifically ahead of time the feelings of maybe a gnawing headache coming on, the desire to get up and run and avoid the situation. I remember those feelings specifically. And yet, I didn't, which is why this was a small victory. At the age of 8, I found myself sitting at the breakfast counter at my grandmother's house. This was the grandma who grew up in the same town. We went to her church with her. She, every Sunday morning after church, would cook us a brunch. My brother and sister and my mom and I, we'd go over there. I think it's how she got us to church, is that she promised breakfast afterwards. And she drove us, so it worked. So I was guaranteed to be at church. So this particular Sunday morning, it was just me and her, sitting across each other from this island. She's got the big griddle, she's cooking, she always did at least a dozen eggs, if not more. It was over the top. And just the two of us are sitting there, and she is saying things to me like, hey, would you fill the glasses? Would you set the table? Would you fold the napkins? Would you this, this, and this? And she always did this thing that just drove me nuts. She would call me Polly. Polly, would you fill the milk glasses? Polly, would you fold the napkins? Polly, would you set the table? The indignity of it was unbearable by the age of 8. It worked the first 7 years, but by the age of 8, I'd had enough. I felt emasculated. I felt somehow diminished by this cute nickname, Polly. Even though this nickname was clearly a term of endearment, clearly a sign of our connection, I had had enough of it. And so I stood my ground that Sunday morning and I said, you know, Grandma, would you just call me Paul from now on? And you know what? She did. She said, Paul, I'll be happy to do that. Happy to call you Paul. And you know what? She still loved me. She still finished breakfast and let me eat at the same table as the rest of the family. She did all these things that I was afraid she would withhold when I stood my ground, right? So interesting, there I was at the age of 8, captive to peacekeeping, to avoidance, captive to the desire to avoid naming difficult truth at all costs. It's the first time I ever did it in my life, and I survived. Jesus, on the other hand, does similar things today. Jesus shows up. He's in the midst of a faithful community. He's in the midst of a people of practice and belief. These are his people, his family and friends. He's been doing this stuff his whole life. We know that his family is faithful, that they pilgrimage to the holy city. We know these things. And the story we hear this go around from the Gospel of John is somewhat different than what we hear from the synoptics. Right? In the synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the ones who see things with the same eyes, synoptic, those Gospels have a particular axe to grind, and it's a good one, right? I mean, they're after the justice issue. They're concerned that there's an injustice happening here at the temple, and they're probably right. And so their notion of Jesus in those stories is that Jesus shows up to right a wrong, and that's great. Hold that in your quiver. But what's happening this morning is a little bit different in the Gospel of John. This story happens on the very front end of Jesus' public ministry. This happens early in the Gospel, which tells us a little something. There's a clue in this, that this is important for helping us understand the rest of everything else that Jesus is going to do. This is a key piece in this confrontation this week. And it's different than just a justice issue. Jesus seems to be showing up, suggesting this week that there's a problem at the temple. And the problem is more than just the practices happening there, but that the problem in that faith community, as in ours today, is perhaps this notion that God and institution are one and the same. Perhaps this notion that we have divinized the institutional life of the place to the degree that it is above reproach, to the degree that we don't get to reflect on our life together, to the degree that we don't get to name when things aren't working, to the degree that we don't get to name when what we do actually excludes people from the life of God, right? What was that? That's a baby. Okay. That was a baby. Quite a squeal. The second thing is this. Not only that, not only does Jesus make the case clearly that God and temple, or God and church, are two radically different realities, connected but radically different, he also makes this particular case, and that is that despite the great 46-year-long effort of building this edifice, it may well be that the life of faith, the life that's in line with the God of Jesus, is a God who is not of building up per se for its own sake, but is a God who is a cycle of building up and falling down, of building up and falling down. That all of this great stuff we've built up around us isn't meant to withhold the pressures and the cares and concerns of the world around us, but is in fact set up to crumble in the face of real world need. This stuff, like the temple, will fall to the ground. It will happen. It will happen. The facilities will fall down. We won't be here anymore. It will all fall to the ground. And the question is this. If that is so, do we believe that that is not the end of the story? Do we believe that if we risk allowing this stuff around us to fall down for the sake of loving the world outside it, do we believe that there will be a life that persists? And do we believe that that life is the life of God in Jesus? Because that's the case Jesus is making today. It's going to fall down, and in 3 days I'll raise it up. I'm not talking about your building, I'm talking about my life. That same life into which we've all been incorporated through baptism. That is the life that exists. That is the life that persists when everything else falls down. Do we believe it? That's the question. So Jesus shows up and he defects in place. He says, look, this isn't working. I'm going to have to differentiate myself from the community of people here who are afraid to name it for what it is. And he does it right up front. And the rest of his public ministry is us figuring out what the life that persists looks like. The life outside the building, what does it look like? And it looks like Jesus It looks like the specific tender ways that he touches people and raises them up. It is the specific ways that he demands justice for those who are broken and beat up by the systems in which we live. It looks like proclamation of hope to the hopeless, food and drink to the hungry and the thirsty. It looks like all these things, and those things persist despite the building. That is how we know that we're living the sacrificial life of Jesus. And it's a pure defection. It's a pure defection at this point because he is saying, this stuff is good, this other stuff is great. It is what we're here for. Richard Rohr talks about this defection as discharging the loyal soldier. Discharging that little voice within us that says, it's better just to put up with this stuff than to name it. It's the little voice that tells us it is too scary to confront stuff that isn't of God. It's too scary to challenge our faith community to be something more than it is currently. It's too scary to say that there's something more than what we're doing right here on Sunday morning. It's too scary to do that. That's what the little soldier tells us. Our loyal soldier who keeps us safe, who keeps us secure. And Richard Rohr says that's great for the first half of life. It needs to be solid and predictable. But if you want to live the second half of life, which is the God life, it is the God life that is free, that is risky, that proclaims difficult truth to the world, that loves the unlovable. If you want to live that life, you've got to get rid of this little loyal soldier who keeps you stuck in the first life. And that is a huge risk. That is a huge danger to us. I think most of us are afraid of it, particularly in the institutional church that's just trying to save its own tail. At St. Mark's, some of this just happens for us. Some of the questions about how are things working just happened for us beautifully in the process of seeking out a new dean for this place. We had difficult conversations. We reflected on things that had worked and not worked. We named some sense of a vision of God. And if you pay attention to the documents, the bulk of it is outside the doors. We have claimed the fact that our life is more than just what we do on Sunday mornings, and now we're sitting waiting to see who's got the guts to challenge us to actually do it. Who's got the guts to get the horse back out in front of the cart? Because most of us have a loyal soldier that is running the show. And we can be gentle with ourselves about that. We can have a sense of humor about it, but it is to be grieved. Because faithfulness to this God who rises up after the whole thing falls down looks more like Jesus, who is out, who is sacrificial, who actually goes through Good Friday, who dies, lives in the tomb for a while, and is raised again. That is our pattern of life when we're being faithful. It assumes Good Friday. It assumes death. It assumes suffering when we go and stand with those outside this place who are crucified daily. If we're in relationship there, it will change us here. And that will be scary. It will be hard for us. But that is what faithfulness looks like. This third Sunday of Lent, we're invited to think about captivity. We're invited to yearn for freedom, and we've got an image today about what that freedom looks like. And it is not all gumdrops and unicorns. It is hard, sacrificial work. That is our vocation. That is our hope. That is our calling. That, in and of itself, is our good news to the world. I hope we'll say yes. For God's sake. Amen.